14 days later, they reached the northern gate of Krondor. As they rode through, they were regarded suspiciously by several guards dressed in black and gold. Once beyond earshot of the gate guards, Lorry said, "Those are not the prince's tabards. The banner of Bastyra flies over Krondor." They rode slowly for a minute. Then Kasumi said, "What does it mean?"
"I don't know,
but I think I know a place we can find out."
They rode through a series of streets bounded on each side by warehouses and commercial enterprises. Sounds from the docks, several streets away, could be heard. Otherwise, the district was quiet.
"Strange," remarked Lorry as they rode on. "This part of the city is usually busiest at this time of day."
Kasumi looked around, not sure of what he expected to see. The Midkemian cities, compared to those of the Empire, seemed small and dirty. Still, there was something strange about the lack of activity here. Both Zun and Yelith had been teeming with soldiers, traders, and citizens at midday, even though they were smaller cities than Krondor. As they rode, a feeling of disquiet visited Kasumi. They entered a section of the city even more run down than the warehouse district. Here the streets were narrow, with 4- and 5-story buildings hugging closely to either side. Dark shadows abounded, even at noon. Those in the street, a few traders and women going to market, moved quietly and with speed. Everywhere the riders looked, they could see expressions of caution and distrust. Lorry led Kasumi to a gate, behind which the upper part of a 3-story building could be seen. Lorry leaned over in the saddle and pulled on a bell rope. When there was no answer after a few minutes, he pulled again. A moment later, a peak window in the door slid aside. 2 eyes could be seen. And a voice said,
"What's your business?"
Lorry's tone was sharp.
"Lucas, is that you? What is happening when travellers can't gain entrance?"
The eyes widened, and the peak window slid shut. The gate swung open with a creaking protest, and a man stepped out to push it wide.
"Lorry, you scoundrel," he said as he admitted the riders. "It's been 6 years.
They rode in, and Lorry was shocked by the condition of the inn. Off to one side was a dilapidated stable. Opposite the gate, a sign hung over the main entrance, depicting in faded hues a parrot of many colours with wings spread. They could hear the gate close behind them. The man called Lucas, tall and gaunt, with grey hair, said,
"You'll have to stable the animals yourself. I am alone here, and must return to the common room before my guests steal everything there. I'll see you and your friend inside, and we can talk."
He turned away, and the 2 riders were left to tend to their mounts. As they removed the saddles from the horses, Lorry said,
"There is a lot happening here that I don't understand. The Rainbow Parrot was never a show place, but it was always one of the better taverns in the poor quarter."
He quietly rubbed down his animal.
"If there is any place we can find out what is truly going on in Krondor, this is it. And one thing I have learned over my years of travelling through the kingdom is when gate guards are watching travellers closely, it is time to stay somewhere they are not likely to visit. You can get your throat cut quickly in the poor quarter, but you'll rarely see a guardsman about. And if they do come, the man who was trying to cut your throat will more than likely hide you until they are gone."
"And then try to cut your throat." Lorry laughed.
"You learn quickly."
When the horses were cared for, the 2 travellers carried their saddles and packs into the inn. Inside, they were greeted by the sight of a dimly lit common room, with a long bar along the rear wall. On the left stood a large fireplace, and on the right, a stairway leading upward. There were a number of empty tables in the room, and two with customers. The newcomers were given a quick look by the guests, who then returned to their drinks and quiet conversation. Laurie and Kasumi crossed over to the bar, where Lucas stood cleaning some wine cups with a less than clean rag. They dropped their packs at their feet, and Laurie said,
"Any Kashian wine?"
Lucas said,
"A little, but it is expensive. There has been little trade with Kesh since the trouble started."
Laurie looked at Lucas as if weighing the cost.
"Then two ales."
Lucas drew two large tankards of ale and said,
"It is good to see you, Laurie. I've missed that tender voice of yours."
Laurie said,
"That's not what you said the last time. As I recall, you likened it to the screeching of a cat looking for a fight."
They chuckled over that, and Lucas said,
"With things so bleak, I have mellowed toward those who were true friends. There are few of us left."
He threw a pointed look at Kasumi. Laurie said,
"This is Kenneth, a true friend of mine, Lucas."
Lucas continued to regard the Serrani for a moment, then smiled.
"Laurie's recommendation counts heavily. Welcome."
He extended his hand, and Kasumi shook with him, kingdom fashion.
"I am pleased that you're welcome."
Lucas frowned at the sound of his accent.
"An outlander?"
"From the Vale of Dreams," said Kasumi.
"The kingdom side,"
added Laurie. Lucas studied the fighter. After a moment, he shrugged.
"Whatever. It matters not a whit to me, but be wary. These are suspicious times, and there is little love wasted on strangers. Take care who you speak with, for there are rumors that Kesh's dog soldiers are ready to move north again, and you are not far from being Keshian."
Before Kasumi could say anything, Laurie said,
"Is there to be trouble with Kesh, then?"
Lucas shook his head.
"I can't say. The market has more rumors than a beggar has boils."
His voice lowered.
"2 weeks back, traders arrived with word the Empire of Great Kesh was again fighting far to the south, seeking to subdue their former vassals in the Confederacy once more. So, things should stay quiet for a while. They learned the folly of a two-front war over 100 years back, when they managed to lose all of Bosania and still not beat the Confederacy."
Laurie said,
"We have been travelling for a very long time and have heard little news. Why is Bastyra's banner over Krondor?"
Lucas quickly looked around the room. The drinkers seemed oblivious to the conversation at the bar, but Lucas motioned for silence.
"I will show you a room,"
he said loudly. Both Laurie and Kasumi were a little surprised, but picked up their belongings and followed Lucas upstairs without comment. He led them to a small room with two beds and a nightstand. When the door was closed behind, he said,
"I trust you, Laurie, so I'll ask no questions, but no, things have changed greatly since last you were here. Even in the poor quarter, there are ears that belong to the Viceroy. Bastyra has the city under his boot heel, and it is a foolish man who speaks without seeing who is listening."
Lucas sat down on one of the beds, and Laurie and Kasumi sat across from him. Lucas continued.
"When Bastyra came to Krondor, he carried the king's warrant, naming him ruler of Krondor, with full vice-regal powers. Prince Erland and his family were locked up in the palace, though Guy calls it protective custody. Then Guy came down hard on the city. Press gangs roam the waterfront, and many a man now sails in Lord Jessup's fleet without his wife or children knowing what became of their old pa. Since then, any who speak against the Viceroy or King simply vanish, because Guy's got a secret police listening at every door in the city. Taxes increase each year to pay for the war, and trade's drying up, except for those selling to the army for the war, and they're getting paid in worthless vouchers. These are hard times, and the Viceroy is doing nothing to make them easier. Food is scarce, and there is little money to pay for what there is. Many farmers have lost their farms for taxes, and now the land lies fallow for want of someone to till it. So, the farmers wander into the city, swelling the population. Most of the young men have been drafted into the army or the fleet. Be careful you aren't picked up by the guards, for whatever reason, and be wary of the press gangs.
Still, Lucas said with a chuckle,
things got lively around here for a time when Prince Arutha came to Krondor.
Boric, son? He's in the city? Asked Laurie.
A twinkle of pleasure showed in Lucas's eyes.
No longer, he chuckled again. Last winter, as bold as bright brass, the prince comes sailing into Krondor. He must have taken the Straits of Darkness during the winter, or he never would have reached the city when he did.
He quickly told them of Arutha and Anita's escape. Laurie said,
did they return to Cridy?
Lucas nodded.
A trader in from Kaas a week ago was full of news of this and that. One thing he heard was some Surani were acting up around Jonril, and the Prince of Cridy was ready to come down to help if needed. So Arutha must have made it back.
Laurie said,
Guy must have been fit to burst at the news.
Lucas's smile vanished.
Well, he was, Laurie. He tossed Prince Erland into the dungeon to get his permission to marry Anita. He kept him there after he heard of Anita's escape. I guess he thought the girl would come back rather than let her father stay in a damp cell. But he was wrong. Now the word's on the street, the prince is near death from the chill. That's why the city's in such a state. No one knows what will happen if Erland dies. He's well liked. And there might be trouble.
Laurie looked at Lucas with an unspoken question.
Nothing like rebellion, Lucas answered. We're too dispirited, but a few of Guy's guards may turn up missing at muster, and there'll be many inconveniences getting supplies to the garrison and palace and the like. And I wouldn't wish to be the Viceroy's taxman when he's next sent into the port quarter.
Laurie considered what he had heard.
We are headed east. What about conditions on the road?
Lucas slowly shook his head.
There is still some travelling done. Once past Darkmoor, you should have scant trouble, I'm thinking. We hear that things in the east are more as they used to be. Still, I'd move carefully.
Kasumi asked, will we be troubled leaving the city?
The North Gate is still the best way. It is undermanned, as usual. For a small fee, the mockers can see you safely through.
Mockers? Asked the fighter. Lucas raised his brows in surprise.
You are from a long way off. The Guild of Thieves. They remain in control of the poor quarter. And the upright man still has influence with the merchants and traders, especially along the docks. The warehouse district is their second home, after the poor quarter. They can get you out, if you have any trouble at the gate.
Laurie said,
we will keep that in mind, Lucas. What of your family? I have not seen them around.
Lucas seemed to shrink into himself.
My wife is dead, Laurie, of the fever, a year ago. My sons are both in the army. I have heard little of them in a year. Last time I received a message, they were in the north with Lords Boric and Brucor. The city is full of veterans of the war. You can see them everywhere. They are the ones with missing limbs or blind eyes. But they always wear their old tabards. And a pathetic sight they are, too.
He got a faraway look in his eyes.
I just hope my boys don't end up like that.
Laurie and Kasumi said nothing. Lucas came out of his reverie.
I must return downstairs. Supper will be ready in 4 hours. Though nothing like I used to serve.
As the innkeeper turned to go, he said,
If you need to contact the Mockers, let me know.
After he had left, Kasumi said,
It is a hard thing to know your country, Laurie, and still look upon the war as glorious.
Laurie nodded. The warehouse was dark and musty. Except for Laurie and Kasumi and 2 fresh horses, it was empty. They had stayed at the Rainbow Parrot the night before and had purchased new mounts at great expense, then had tried to leave the city. When they had reached the city gates, they had been stopped by a detachment of Bas Tyra's guards. When it was obvious that the guards were not likely to let them leave without trouble, Laurie and Kasumi had broken away from them, and a mad dash through the city had followed. They had lost their pursuers in the poor quarter, and had returned to the Rainbow Parrot. Lucas had sent word to the upright man, and now they waited for a thief to guide them out of the city. A whistle broke the silence, and Laurie and Kasumi had their swords in hand in an instant. A high-pitched chuckle greeted them, and a small figure dropped from above. In the dark, it was difficult to see where the figure sprang from, but Laurie suspected their visitor had been hiding in the rafters for some time. The figure stepped forward, and in the dim light, they could see it was a boy, no older than 13.
There's a party at Mother's,
the newcomer said.
And a good time will be had by all,
Laurie answered.
You're the travellers, then?
You're the guide? Asked Kasumi, taking no effort to hide the surprise in his voice. The boy's voice was filled with bravado.
Aye, Jimmy the Hand is your guide, and a better one in all Kronda you'll not find.
Laurie said, What's to be done?
First, there's the matter of payment. It's 100 sovereigns each.
Without comment, Laurie dug out several small gems and handed them over.
Will these do?
The boy turned to the warehouse door and cracked it slightly, admitting a shaft of moonlight. He inspected the gems with an expert's eye and returned to stand before the 2 fugitives.
These'll do. For 100, you can have this.
He offered a piece of parchment. Laurie took it, but couldn't make out what was written on it in the dim light.
What is it?
Jimmy chuckled.
A royal warrant, allowing the bearer to travel the king's highway.
Is it genuine? Asked the minstrel.
My word, I nicked it myself from a trader from Ludland this morning. It's valid for 1 month.
Done, said Laurie, and the minstrel gave the boy another gem. When the gems were safely in the thief's pouch, he said,
Soon we'll be hearing a brouhaha at the gate. A few of the boys will put on some mummery for the guards. When everything's up in the wind, we'll slip through.
He returned to the door and looked out without further comment. While they waited, Kasumi whispered,
Can he be trusted?
No, but we have no choice.
If the upright man could show a larger profit by turning us in, he might. But the Mockers have little love for the guards, and now less than usual, according to Lucas. So it is unlikely. Still, keep your wits about you.
Time stretched on interminably. Then suddenly shouts could be heard. Jimmy signaled with a sharp whistle, which was answered by another from outside.
It's time,
he said, and was out the door. Laurie and Kasumi led their horses out after him.
Follow closely and quickly,
their small guide said as he set off. They rounded the corner of a building and could see the north gate. A group of men were involved in a brawl, many appearing to be sailors from the docks. The guards were doing their best to restore order, but each time one pushed a combatant away from the fray, another would appear from the shadows around the gate and join in. In a few minutes, every guard was involved in breaking up the fight. And Jimmy said, "Now!" He broke from the building, with the travelers close behind, and dashed to the wall next to the gatehouse. They edged their way along in the shadows, the horses' clatter covered by the noise of the brawl. When they were near the gate, a single guard could be seen, on the other side, whom they hadn't been able to see from their previous location. Laurie gripped Jimmy's shoulder.
"We'll have to take him quickly."
Jimmy said,
"No, if weapons are drawn, the guards will leave that little bit of fun like a burning whorehouse. Leave him to me."
Jimmy sprang forward and ran to the guard. As the guard brought his spear forward across his chest and shouted, "Halt!" Jimmy kicked him hard in the leg above the boot. The man let out a howl, then looked at his small assailant with fury on his face.
"Why, you little—"
Jimmy stuck out his tongue and started to run toward the docks. The guards set out in hot pursuit, and the two travelers slipped through the gate. Once outside the city, they mounted quickly and rode off. As they rode away from Krondor, they could hear the sounds of the brawl. They rested a day at Darkmoor, in an inn in the town below the castle. They had been 2 days in the hills, and needed to rest their mounts before journeying over the grasslands to Malak's Cross. The town was quiet, and little of interest occurred until the inn door opened and a man in dirty brown robes entered. The man was old and bent with years, and thin to the point of gauntness. The innkeeper looked up from cleaning ale cups and said,
"What do you wish?"
Softly the old man said,
"Please, sir, a little food."
"Can you pay?"
"I can fashion spells to rid your inn of vermin, should you be plagued by rats, sir. Perhaps—"
"Be gone! I have no food for beggars or magicians. Get out!
And if I find my milk clabbered, I'll set my dogs upon you."
The magician looked around. Laurie reached across the table and touched Kasumi upon the arm. His Serrani heritage was betraying him, as he was showing open astonishment at what he saw. Before him stood a magician, being treated as shabbily as his clothes. Laurie's touch caused him to regain his composure. The magician slowly turned and left the inn. Laurie sprang up and crossed to the innkeeper. Slapping some coins on the table, he said,
"Quick, a joint of cold meat, a loaf of bread, and a skin of wine."
The innkeeper looked surprised, but the coins on the bar convinced him to do as ordered. When the items ordered were upon the bar, Laurie scooped them up. He paused a moment to grab a wedge of cheese off a platter and rushed out the door. Kasumi was as amazed as the innkeeper appeared to be. Laurie looked down the road and saw the old man, his posture erect, as he moved along with a staff in one hand, using it as a walking stick. He ran after the man and, when he had overtaken him, said,
"Excuse me, but I was in the tavern a moment ago and—"
He held out the food and wineskin. He saw pride diminish in the old man's eyes.
"Why are you doing this, minstrel?"
Laurie said,
"I have a friend who is a magician, a special friend. He did me a great kindness once, and I—"
"It's something of a repayment." The magician accepted this explanation and took the food. While he struggled with the burden, Laurie slipped a pair of gems into the magician's empty belt pouch. There would be enough there to ensure the magician never had to go hungry again if he lived modestly.
"What is this magician's name? Perhaps I know him."
"Melamba."
The old man shook his head.
"I have not heard of him. Where does he abide?"
Laurie looked to the west, where the sun set behind the hills. With strong emotions in his voice, he said,
"Far from here, my friend.
very far from here. The ship beat against the waves while the crew reefed the sails. Laurie and Kasumi stood on deck, watching the spires and towers of Rillinon as the ship put into harbour.
A fabulous city, said the former Serrani officer. Not as large as the cities of home, but so different. All those tiny fingers of stone and the colours of the banners make it look like a city of legend.
Strange, said Laurie. Pug and I felt the same when we first saw Jamar. I suppose it is simply that they're so different from each other.
They stood on the open deck, cool in the breezes, but still able to feel the warmth of the sun. Both were dressed in the finest clothing they could buy in Salador, for they wished to be presentable at court and knew they had little chance of being admitted to see the king should they look like simple vagabonds. The ship's captain ordered the last sails taken in, and the ship slid into place alongside the docks a few moments later. Ropes were thrown to men waiting on the quay, and the vessel was quickly made fast. As soon as they were able, the two travellers were down the gangway and making their way through the city. Rillinon, the fabled and ancient capital of the Kingdom of the Isles, stood bedecked in colours, flashing brightly in the sunlight. But there was an undercurrent of tension in the atmosphere of the streets and markets. Everywhere they passed, people spoke in hushed tones, as if they feared someone might overhear them. And even the hawkers in the street stalls seemed to offer their wares half-heartedly. It was nearly the noon hour, and without seeking rooms, they headed straight for the palace. When they reached the main gate, an officer in the purple and gold of the Royal Household Guard inquired their business. Laurie said,
"We bring messages of the greatest importance to the king regarding the war."
The officer considered. They were dressed well enough, and didn't appear to be the usual madmen with predictions of doom, or prophets of some nameless truth, but they were not officials of the court or army either. He decided on the course of action followed most often in the armies of all nations in all times, passing them along to a higher authority. A guard escorted them to the office of an assistant to the Royal Chancellor. Here they were made to wait for a half hour before the assistant would see them. They entered the man's office and were confronted by the steward of the royal household, a self-important little man with a pot belly and a chronic wheeze when he spoke.
"What business do you gentlemen have?"
he inquired, making it clear that his estimation of them was provisional.
"We carry word to the king regarding the war,"
Laurie answered.
"Oh?"
he sniffed.
"And why aren't these documents or messages or whatever they are being delivered by the proper military pouch?"
Kasumi, obviously frustrated with the wait now that they were in the palace, said,
"Let us speak with someone who can take us to the king."
The steward of the royal household looked outraged.
"I am Baron Grey. I am the one to whom you will speak, man, and I have a good mind to have the guards toss you into the street. His Majesty cannot be bothered with every charlatan who tries to seek an audience. I am the one you must satisfy, and you have not."
Kasumi stepped forward and gripped the man by the front of his tunic.
"And I am Kasumi of the Shinzawe. My father is Komatsu, Lord of the Shinzawe, and war chief of the Kanazawe clan. I will see your king."
Lord Grey paled visibly. He frantically pulled at Kasumi's hand and tried to speak. His shock at what he had just heard and what he felt at being handled this way raced within him. It all proved to be too much for him to speak. He nodded frantically until Kasumi released him. Brushing at his tunic front, the man said,
"The Royal Chancellor will be informed at once."
He walked to a door, and Laurie watched him in case he called for guards, thinking them madmen. Whatever else the man thought, Kasumi's manner convinced him he was something quite different from anything heretofore seen. A messenger was sent, and in a few minutes an elderly man entered the room. He simply said,
"What is it?"
"Your Grace," said the steward, "I think you had best talk to these men and consider if His Majesty should see them."
The man turned to study the two other men in the office.
"I am Duke Caldric, the Royal Chancellor. What reason do you have to see His Majesty?"
Kasumi said,
"I bring a message from the Emperor of Suranuani."
The king sat in a pavilion on a balcony overlooking the harbour. Below, a mountain river passed directly before the palace, part of the original defence design, though no longer needed as a moat. Graceful bridges could be seen arching above it, carrying people from one side of the river to the other. King Roderick sat, seemingly attentive to what Kasumi was saying. He toyed absently with a golden ball in his right hand, while Kasumi outlined in detail the Emperor's message of peace. Roderick was silent for a while after Kasumi finished, as if weighing what he had heard. Kasumi handed a sheaf of documents to Duke Caldric, then waited for the king's answer. After another moment of silence, Kasumi added, "The Emperor's proposals are outlined in these parchments in detail, Your Majesty, should you wish to study them at your leisure. I will wait upon your convenience to carry your reply." Still Roderick was silent, and the courtiers gathered nearby looked at one another nervously. Kasumi was about to speak again when the king said,
"I am always amused when watching my little subjects hurrying about the city, like so many ants. I often wonder what they think, living out their simple little lives."
He turned to look at the two emissaries.
"You know, I could order any one of them put to death. Just pick one out from this very balcony, should I choose. I could just say to my guards, 'See that fellow in the blue cap? Go hack his head off.' And they would, you know. That's because I'm king."
Lorry felt a chill run up his back. This was worse than anything he had imagined. The king seemed not to have heard a single word spoken. Kasumi said very quietly in the Sirani language,
"If we should fail, one of us must carry word back to my father."
At this, the king's head snapped up. His eyes grew wide, and he spoke with a tremble in his voice.
"What is this?"
His voice rose in pitch.
"I will have no one whispering."
His face took on a feral appearance.
"You know they are always whispering about me, the disloyal ones. But I know who they are, and I will see them on their knees before me. Yes, I will. That traitor Keras was on his knees before I had him hanged. I would have hanged his family had they not fled to Kesh."
He then studied Kasumi.
"You think to trick me with your strange story and these so-called documents. Any fool could see through your guise. You are spies."
Duke Caldric looked pained and tried to calm the king. Several guards stood nearby, shifting their weight from foot to foot, uncomfortable at what they were hearing. The king pushed the solicitous duke away. His voice took on a near hysterical tone.
"You are agents of that traitor Boric! He and my uncle were plotting to take my throne, but I stopped that. My uncle Erland is dead."
He paused for a moment, as if confused.
"No, I mean he is ill. That is why my loyal Duke Guy was sent from Bastyra to rule Krondor until my beloved uncle was well."
His eyes seemed to clear for a moment. Then he said,
"I am not feeling well. Please excuse me. I will speak to you again tomorrow."
He rose from his chair. After he had taken a step, He turned back to look at Lorry and Kasumi.
What was it you wanted to see me about? Oh, yes, peace. Yes, that is good. This war is a terrible thing. We must end it so that I can go back to my building. We must begin the building again.
A page took the king's arm and led him away. The royal chancellor said,
Follow me, and say nothing.
He hurried them through the palace and led them to a room with two guards before the door. One guard opened the door for them, and they entered. Inside, they found a bedroom with two large beds and a table with chairs in the corner. The chancellor said,
Your arrival is poorly timed. Our king is, as you no doubt can see, a sick man, and I fear that he will not recover. I hope he will be better able to understand your message tomorrow. Please stay here until you are sent for. A meal will be brought to you.
He crossed over to the door, and before he left said,
Until tomorrow.
A shout awoke them in the night. Lorry rose quickly and went to the window. Peering through the curtains, he could see a figure on the balcony below. In his nightshirt, King Roderick stood sword in hand, poking into the bushes. Lorry opened the window as Kasumi joined him. From below they could hear the king's cries,
Assassins! They have come!
Guards ran out and searched the bushes, while court pages led the shrieking monarch back to his room. Kasumi said,
In truth, the gods have touched him. They must surely hate your nation.
Lorry said,
I am afraid, friend Kasumi, that the gods have little to do with this. Right now, I think we had best see to finding a way out of here. I have a feeling that His Royal Majesty is ill-suited for the finer points of negotiating a peace. I think we had best make our way west and speak with Duke Borick.
Will he be able to stop the war, this Duke? Lorry crossed over to the chair upon which his clothing was draped. Picking up his tunic, he said,
I hope so. If the lords here can watch the king behave in such a manner and do nothing, then we will have civil war soon. Better to settle one war before beginning another.
They dressed quickly. Lorry said,
Let us hope we can find a ship putting out on the morning tide. If the king orders the port closed, we are trapped. It is a long swim.
As they gathered up their belongings, the door opened and the royal chancellor entered. He stopped and saw them standing there, fully dressed.
Good, he said, quickly closing the door. You have as much sense as I had hoped you would. The king has ordered the spies put to death.
Lorry was incredulous.
He thinks us spies?
Duke Caldric sat in one of the chairs by the table, fatigue clearly showing on his face.
Who knows what His Majesty is thinking these days? There are a few of us who try to stay his more terrible impulses, but it becomes more and more difficult each day. There is a sickness in him that is terrible to watch. Years ago he was an impetuous man, it is true, but there was also a vision to his plans, a certain mad brilliance that could have made this the greatest nation in Midkemia. There are many in the court now who take advantage of him, using his fears to further their own designs. I am afraid that soon I will be branded traitor and join the others in death.
Kasumi buckled on his sword.
Why stay, Your Grace? If this is true, why not come with us to Duke Borick?
The Duke looked at the oldest son of the Shinzawe.
I am a noble of the kingdom, and he is my king. I must do whatever I can to keep him from harming the kingdom, even if the price is my life. But I cannot raise arms against him, nor aid those who do. I don't know how things are with your world, Surani. But here I must stay. He is my king.
Kasumi nodded. I understand. In your place, I would do the same. You are a brave man, Duke Caldric. The Duke stood.
I am a tired man. The king has taken strong drink from my hand. He will drink from no other, for he fears poison.
I had the Courageon give him something for sleep. You should be out to sea when he awakens. I don't know if he will remember your visit, but rest assured that someone will remind him within a day, or two at the outside. So do not linger. Make straight for Lord Boric and tell him what has happened.
Lorry said,
Is Prince Erland truly dead?
Yes. Word reached us a week ago. His failing health could not withstand the cold dungeon. Boric is now heir to the throne. Roderick has never wed. His fear of others is too deep. The fate of the kingdom rests with Boric. Tell him so.
They crossed to the door. Before the Duke opened it, he said,
Also tell him that it is likely I will be dead should he come to Rillanon. It will be a good thing, for I would have to stand against any who raised arms against the royal standard.
Before Lorry or Kasumi could say anything, he opened the door. Two guards stood outside, and the Duke ordered them to escort Lorry and Kasumi to the docks.
The Royal Swallow is anchored in the harbour. Give this to the captain.
He held out a piece of paper to Lorry.
It is a royal warrant commanding him to carry you to Salador.
He held out a second paper.
This is another, commanding any of the armies of the kingdom to aid your travel.
They grasped each other by the hand. Then the two emissaries followed the guards down the corridor. Lorry looked over his shoulder at Caldric as they left. The old Duke waited, stoop-shouldered and tired, his face lined by worry and sorrow, as well as fear. As they turned a corner, losing sight of the Duke, Lorry thought no price in the world would make him exchange places with that old man. The horses were lathered. The riders whipped them up the hill. They were on the last leg of their journey to Lord Boric, begun over a month before, and the end was in sight. The Royal Swallow had sped them to Salador, where they had left at once for the west. They had slept little along the way, trading for fresh mounts or commandeering them, whenever possible, from horse patrols with a royal warrant given them by Caldric. Lorry wasn't sure, but he suspected they had covered the distance faster than it had ever been travelled before. Several times since leaving Zoon, they had been challenged by soldiers. Each time they had presented the Chancellor's warrant and were passed through. Now they approached the Duke's camp. The Serrani warlord had unleashed his major offensive. The kingdom forces had held for a week, then collapsed, when 10,000 fresh Serrani soldiers had come pouring through their lines, tipping the balance. The fighting had been bitter then, a raging, running battle lasting 3 days before the kingdom army was finally routed. When it was over, a large portion of the front had fallen, and the Serrani had thrown up a salient out of the North Pass. Now the elves and dwarves, as well as the castles of the far coast, were cut off from the main force of the kingdom army. There was no communication of any sort, for the pigeons used to carry messages had been destroyed when the old camp had been overrun. The fate of the other fronts was unknown. The armies of the west were regrouping, and it took Lorry and Kasumi some time to find the headquarters camp. As they rode up to the command pavilion, they saw signs of bitter defeat on every side. It was the worst setback of the war for the kingdom. Everywhere they looked, they saw wounded or sick men, and those who showed no wounds had the look of despair. A guard sergeant inspected their warrant and sent a guard with them to show them where the Duke's tent stood. They reached the large command tent, and a lackey took their mounts from them as the guard went inside. A moment later, a tall young man, blonde-bearded and wearing the tabard of Cridy, came out. Behind him appeared a stout man with a grey beard, a magician by his garb, and another man, large, with a ragged scar down his face. Laurie wondered if they might be the old friends Pug had spoken of, but quickly focused his attention on the young officer, who stopped before him. "I bring a message to Lord Borrick." The young man smiled a bitter smile, then said, "You may give me the message, sir. I am Liam, his son." Laurie said, "I mean no disrespect, Highness, but I must speak with the Duke in person." "So I was instructed by Duke Caldric." At mention of the Royal Chancellor's name, Liam exchanged glances with his companions, then held aside the tent flap. Laurie and Kasumi entered, the others following. Inside there was a small brazier burning and a large table with maps upon it. Liam led them to another section of the huge tent, curtained off from the rest. He pulled back the hanging, and they saw a man lying upon a sleeping pallet. He was a tall man, with dark hair streaked with grey. His face was drawn, drained of blood, his lips nearly blue. His breathing was ragged, each breath rattling loudly as he slept. He wore clean bedclothing, but heavy bandages could be seen beneath his loose collar. Liam put back the hanging as another man entered the tent. Old, with a near white mane of hair, he was still erect and broad-shouldered. Softly he said, "What is this?" Liam answered, "These men bring messages for father from Caldric." The old warrior stuck out his hand. "Give them to me." When Laurie hesitated, the man nearly barked, "Damn it, fellow, I'm Brucall. With Borrick wounded, I'm commander of the armies of the West." Laurie said, "I've no written message, Your Grace. Duke Caldric says to introduce my companion. This is Kasumi of the Shinzawe, emissary of the Emperor of Suranuani, who carries an offering of peace to the king." Liam said, "Is there to be peace at last?" Laurie shook his head. "Sadly, no. The Duke also said to say this. The king is mad, and the Duke of Bas Tyra has slain Prince Erland. He fears only Lord Borrick can save the kingdom." Brucall was visibly shaken by the news. To Liam, he quietly said, "Now we know the rumours to be true. Erland was Guy's prisoner. Erland dead. I can scarcely believe it." Shaking off his shock, he said, "Liam, I know your mind is upon your father now, but you must bend thought to this. Your father is near death. You will soon be Duke of Cridy. And with Erland dead, you will also be heir to the throne by right of birth." Brucall sat heavily upon a stool near the map table. "This is a heavy burden thrust upon you, Liam. But others in the West will look to you for leadership, as they once looked to your father. If there was ever any love between the two realms, it is now strained to the breaking point, with Guy upon the throne in Krondor. It is now clear for all to see, Bas Tyra means to be king, for a mad Roderick cannot be allowed his throne much longer." He fixed Liam with a steady gaze. "You will soon have to decide what we in the West shall do. Upon your word, we have civil war." Chapter 11. Decision. The Holy City was festive. Banners flew from every tall building. People lined the streets, throwing flowers before the nobles who were carried on their litters to the stadium. It was a day of high celebration, and who could feel troubled on such a day? One who did feel troubled arrived in the pattern room of the stadium, the final reverberations of a chime signalling the appearance of a Great One of Suranuani. Malamba shrugged off his preoccupation for a moment as he left the pattern room, near the central gallery of the Grand Imperial Stadium. The crowd of Surani nobles, idling away the time before the games began, parted to allow Malamba to pass through the archway leading to the magician's seats. Glancing around the small sea of black robes, he noticed Shimon and Hocho Pepper, who were keeping a place for him. They signaled greetings as he left the aisle between the magician's section and the imperial parties, and joined them. Below, on the arena floor, some of the dwarf-like folk from Subar, the so-called Lost Land across the Sea of Blood, were fighting large insect creatures, like Choja, but without intelligence. Soft wooden swords and essentially harmless bites from mandibles provided a conflict more comic than dangerous. The commoners and lesser nobles, already in their seats, laughed in appreciation. These contests kept them amused while the great and near-great were waiting to enter the stadium. Tardiness in Suranuani became a virtue when one reached a certain social level. Shimon said, "It is a shame you took so long getting here, Malamba. There was a singularly fine match a short while ago." "I was under the impression the killing wasn't to begin just yet." Hocho Pepper, munching nuts cooked in sweet oil, said, "True, but our friend Shimon is something of an aficionado of the games." Shimon said, "Earlier, young officers of noble family fought with training weapons to first blood, to better display their skills and win honors for their clans. Not to mention the fruits of some rather heavy wagering," interjected Hocho Pepper. Ignoring the remark, Shimon continued, "There was a spirited match between sons of the Oranaima and the Kida. I've not seen a better display in years." While Shimon described the match, Malamba let his gaze wander. He could see the small standards of the Kida, Minwanabi, Oaxaca Toucan, Zacatecas, Anasati, and other great families of the empire. He noticed that the banner of the Shinzawe was absent and wondered at it. Hocho Pepper said, "You seem much preoccupied, Malamba." Malamba nodded agreement. "Before leaving for today's festival, I received word that a motion to reform land taxes and abolish debt slavery had been introduced in the High Council yesterday. The message came from the Lord of the Tuklamekla, and I couldn't for the life of me understand why he sent it until, near the end, he thanked me for providing the concepts of social reform the motion was intended to enact. I was appalled at such an action." Shimon laughed. "Had you been so thick-witted a student, you'd still be wearing the white robe." Malamba looked back blankly, and Hocho Pepper said, "You go about causing all sorts of rumblings with your speeches before the assembly, constantly harping on all manner of social ills, and then sit dumbfounded because someone out there listened?" "What I said to our brother magicians was not intended for discussion outside the assembly halls." "How unreasonable," said Hocho Pepper. "Someone in the assembly spoke to a friend who wasn't a magician." "What I'd like to know," said Shimon, "is how this potful of reforms placed before the High Council by the Hunzan clan has your name appended to it." Malamba looked uncomfortable, to the delight of his friends. "One of the young artists who worked on the murals at my estate is a son of the Tuklamekla. We did discuss differences between Surani and kingdom cultures and social values, but only as an outgrowth of our discussions of the differences in styles of art." Hocho Pepper looked skyward, as if seeking divine guidance. "When I heard the Party for Progress, which is dominated by the Hunzan clan,
which is dominated by the Tuklamekla family, cited you as inspiration, I could scarcely believe my hearing. But now I can see your hand is in every problem plaguing the Empire.
He looked at his friend with a mock serious expression.
Tell me, is it true the Party for Progress is going to change its name to the Party of Malamba?
Shimon laughed while Malamba fixed Hocho Pepper with a baleful look. Katala thinks it amusing when I get upset by this sort of thing, Hocho. And you might think it funny as well, but I want it publicly known I did not intend for this to happen. I simply offered some observations and opinions, and what the Hunzan clan and the Party for Progress does with them is not my doing. Hocho Pepper said, in chiding tones,
I fear if so famous a personage as yourself wishes not to have such things occur, then such a personage should have his mouth sewn shut.
Shimon laughed, and Malamba felt his own mirth rise.
Very well, Hocho, answered Malamba. I will take the blame. Still, I don't know if the Empire is yet ready for the changes I think needed.
Shimon said, We have heard your arguments before, Malamba, but today is not the time, nor is this the place for social debate.
Let us attend to the matters at hand. Remember, many of the Assembly are offended by your concerns over matters they judge political. And while I tend to support your notions as refreshing and progressive, keep in mind you are making enemies.
Trumpets and drums sounded, signalling the approach of the Imperial Party and cutting off further conversation. The Subar folk and the insectoids were chased from the arena, handlers herding them away. When the field was cleared, groundskeepers hurried out with rakes and drags to smooth the sand. The sound of the trumpets could be heard again, and the first members of the Imperial procession, heralds in the Imperial white, entered. They carried long, curved trumpets, fashioned from the horns of some large beast, which curled around their shoulders to end above their heads. They were followed by drummers, who beat a steady tattoo. When they were in position in the front of the Imperial box, the warlord's honor guard entered. Each wore armor and helm finished in Nidra hide, bleached free of all color. Around the breastplate and helm of each, precious gold trim gleamed in the sun. Malamba heard Hocho Pepper mutter at the waste of this rare metal. When they were stationed, a senior herald shouted, Almicho, warlord! And the crowd rose, cheering. He was accompanied by his retinue, including several in black robes, the warlord's pet magicians, as the others of the assembly referred to them. Chief among these were the two brothers, Elgahar and Urgaran. Then the herald cried, Ichindar, 91 times emperor! The crowd roared its approval as the young light of heaven made his entrance. He was attended by priests of each of the 20 orders. The crowd stood, thundering. On and on it went. And Malamba wondered if the love of the Serrani people would sustain the light of heaven should a confrontation between warlord and emperor take place. In spite of the Serrani reverence for tradition, he did not think the warlord a man to step down meekly from his office, a thing unheard of in history, should the emperor so order. As the noise died down, Shimon said,
It seems, friend Malamba, that the contemplative life doesn't suit the light of heaven. Can't say that I blame him, sitting around all day with no one for company but a lot of priests and silly girls chosen for their beauty instead of conversational ability. Must become frightfully boring.
Malamba laughed.
I doubt most men would agree.
Shimon shrugged.
I constantly forget you were quite old when you were trained.
And you have a wife also. At mention of wives, Hocho Pepper looked pained. He interrupted. The warlord is going to make an announcement. Almicho rose and held his hands aloft for silence. When the stadium fell quiet, his voice rang out.
The gods smile upon Suranuani. I bring news of a great victory over the otherworld barbarians. We have crushed their greatest army, and our warriors celebrate. Soon all the lands called the kingdom will be laid at the light of heaven's feet.
He turned and bowed deferentially to the emperor. Malamba felt a stab at the news. Without being aware, he began to stand, only to have Hocho Pepper grip his arm and hiss,
You are Serrani!
Malamba shook himself free of the unexpected shock and composed himself.
Thank you, Hocho. I nearly forgot myself. Hush, said Hocho Pepper.
They returned their attention to the warlord.
And as a sign of our devotion to the light of heaven, we dedicate these games to his honor.
A cheer rang through the arena, and the warlord sat down.